Welcome to the From Survivor to Thriver podcast. I'm Mark Fernandes. Each week, along with my co-host Eric DeRosa, we aim to shatter the stigma around mental health conversations through kitchen table conversations with real and relatable people, all the while reminding our audience that they are not alone. There is hope, there is help, and there is a way through. Enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to From Survivor to Thriver, episode 156. This is one of your co-hosts, Mark Fernandes, from my usual chair, along the bustling and half-frozen, half-running Brush Creek today. And let's send it across to my ever-shouting podcast host and wonderful friend and amazing person, even when I tease him, Eric DeRosa. How are we this evening?
I'm good. I'm still recovering from about 10 minutes ago. There's like an echo in my ear. And so if I don't pick up on what our guest is saying right away, it's just I'm trying to regain my hearing during the next 60 minutes.
There are worse voices to have echoing.
There are. And I've had them. And we've talked on this.
We've talked about how when you're skiing, sometimes you hear Mark saying, well, if you just went a little faster.
Yes. And we've talked about the intrusive voices and all those things that used to be in my head. So if I had to pick one voice other than my wife's, which I would have to hear at a loud volume occasionally once in a while, reminding me of things, it would, of course, be yours.
I actually had the intrusive voices last night. I've got a crazy amount of work going on, friends coming to visit, family coming to visit, just so much. And I had one of those nights just laying there exhausted with the brain, just like, and I even did all my usual stuff, like made the list. Like if I make the list for the next day, I can usually be like, okay, those are things I'm doing tomorrow. Then I get up and eat some ice cream. Even the dog was looking at me like, bro, go to sleep.
Well, if I remember correctly, this is becoming a very busy and bustling time for you in all aspects of your career, both on and off the snow. So I know it's not going to slow down anytime soon. And it's also a very good reminder for our audience who's listening right now that even though we have, right, all the tools and all the things, and there are just some times where things might not work, and yeah, you just have to sit with it.
100%.
And you just have to sit with it.
No, I think the worst thing you could do, like, without getting too deep into this, someone was like, well, what's coming? Why do you let it stress you out? And I'm like, that's like being like, oh, the asteroid's coming, relax. But just because you have the awareness of it. And look, I manage it much better. I don't get as angry. I don't beat myself up as much. But the fact of the matter is, when there's too much to do, and you can be as proactive as you want, but, you know, life is full of surprises, right?
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I had a pleasant surprise today. A certain someone who I skied with spent a little bit of time with you and Fluffy and looked a little bit different.
Yeah, no, I beat it into him. He's stubborn.
He's stubborn. And he did still spend a fair amount of time on the snow, not skis on the snow, but body on the snow.
Or skating on his inside foot.
And it was a lot of fun to see. And we had a really great day out there. And he has nothing but amazing words to say about the two of you. And I will be joining you at the end of the month.
I figured that invite was coming.
Yes, for the boys' ski day. Well, enough of us. Let's go to one of our old homes in New York City, because joining us today is John Katz. In late 2020, he went through a horrendous breakup. This breakup, compounded with the weight of an unstable childhood, decades of poor decision-making, poor relationship choices, and poor habits, left him obese, anxious, depressed, and suicidal at the young age of 34. Since then, John has turned his life around in every conceivable way and now coaches others on how to step back from the path of negativity, poor health, hopelessness, worthlessness, fear, and suicide. It is now his life's mission to help folks out of the pit of suicidality, anxiety, depression, repression, and denial, all while taking back their lives. With that, let's go to the borough of Manhattan to welcome in our guest, John.
Pleased to be here, guys. Appreciate you having me.
So happy to have you. And as somebody who has unfortunately suffered through suicidal ideation, depression, and feelings of worthlessness, I'm
so happy to be sitting here talking today. So thanks for staying. And I just listening to your bio and hearing, it's amazing how often we think a relationship or someone else is going to complete us, or and every romance movie kind of pushes us into that. When did you realize that you had to go internally versus externally to live a better life?
I finally realized that happiness was an inside job when I sort of had lost all of the external stuff. So much of my motivation before getting healthy was based on how I thought other people would perceive me. So I wanted to be externally defined by the woman I was dating. I wanted to be externally defined by being cool and going out, doing all the things that are expected of me by the outer group. But what I was too naive or blind to see is that the outer group is mentally ill, overweight, anxious, and depressed. And so in looking for validation from this group of people, I was essentially adopting their habits. And in doing so, I was getting their problems along with it. And after the relationship ended, it sort of stripped bare a lot of things I had been running and hiding from. I didn't have the stabilizing force of girlfriend, or I guess in this case, it was my fiance in my life anymore. And so I was running amok. I was doing all the same negative things I was doing in the relationship, but without someone to stabilize me, I was just going all in, drinking multiple times a week, using drugs every week, sleeping around as much as I could, trying to just bury myself in all of this stuff. And none of it made me happy. It actually made me miserable, and so miserable that that's when I considered ending my life. And then when I flipped a switch and decided only to work on me and my insides and try to develop myself internally, that's when I finally understood that everything outside of us is going to lead us away from happiness and everything inside of us.
Well, to echo Mark's sentiment, so glad you're here and thank you for staying. We're all so much better off for you still being with us. And we actually have kind of a unique opportunity here. And I'm curious, we haven't, to my knowledge, had any other guests on our show before who actually grew up in New York City. And I know you grew up in New York and you moved around.
Just Veronica, right?
Just Veronica, yeah.
Yeah, so you're only the second.
You're only the second one. And you came back to New York. I'm curious, how did growing up in New York City for you impact some of, as you talk about, like your childhood and other things, how did it impact that? And then did growing up in New York City in many ways lead to you kind of running away from the city and some of the things that might have existed in your life at that time?
Absolutely. Like everything in this life, it is a blessing and a curse, often in equal measure. So I credit New York City giving me a real cultured worldview. It's undeniable that I'm interested in things I can only be interested in because I was exposed to them at a young age. But also New York is a challenging place to exist. And through no real fault of their own, I was raised in a situation that maybe wasn't as solid or stable as it could have been due to a lot of the challenges that New York City presents in terms of demands on resources and whatnot. Plus, it's a very high-paced, some would say anxious place to begin with. So raising in that environment, being around a lot of, I'm very fortunate because a lot of people that I grew up with that actually had a lot more than I did economically, I would often hear complaining about their stature and their status in life. I didn't really fall victim to that, but I was exposed to the excess of New York City. The real challenges came from just not really having what I needed in the kind of spiritual or emotional support type of way. But I got exactly what I needed from intellectual stimulation type of way, museums and the arts and letters and all of that. Or my personality, I was exposed to independent cinema, literature, and art at a very young age, often was self-motivated. I famously learned to read before I was 3 years old. I put everything on that, and learning how to read at 2 and change, that sort of set, I've always been into books and whatnot, and books provided an escape from what was kind of a lot of turbulence at home. So I've always been into that stuff, and I tie all of that intellectualism and all of that cultural stuff very much into my upbringing. But what I realized at 34 is all of that also didn't really give me a leg to stand on in the real world. A lot of the intellectual stuff and the cultural stuff I was drawn to, and to a lesser degree I'm drawn to, is somewhat alienating because it's someone else's narrative. I love Hemingway. I love Foster Wallace. May he rest in peace. I love George Orwell. I love Guy Debord. I love all of these writers and authors, but obsessing about the cultural creations of others without creating something myself didn't really get me where I wanted to go. But after I started working on myself, I actually started writing and making my own art, making my own YouTube, creating tons of social media content. And it was only when I stopped focusing on other people and obsessing about what other people were doing and solely focused on me that I felt, and I'm still doing this today, that I was able to develop myself into a person that could really contribute and give back. I know it's kind of a roundabout way of discussing New York City, but that you also mentioned running. So I'll take that.
Pun intended.
I got into university pretty far away from New York. I went to school in New Orleans and I left at 18. And after I graduated, I kept home base in New Orleans, but I did what a lot of middle-class kids do. And after college, I went traveling. Now, this was not some all-expenses-paid posh vacation. I was working on farms around the world. I was trading labor. There's a number of programs, and I joined one where you trade your labor for room and board. I wasn't slumming it, but this was not a posh vacation. This was me doing hard physical labor pretty much 6 days a week. And at the time, I felt it was motivated by an interest to learn. So I was interested in food and agriculture and organics. And to some degree, it was, but it was really a way of continuing that running. Oftentimes, I've noticed people that travel a lot, not always, but are not super okay with who they are at home. And so they seek to physically move. In AA, I'm not a member of AA, but in AA, they call this doing a geographic. So you're physically moving your body. But of course, if you carry pain in your heart, that pain is going to be with you wherever you go. And I definitely carried that to every country I went to. I would just have the same problems in France. I would have the same problems in New Zealand. And I was learning all these things and skills, and it definitely shaped me and molded me. And it was a blessing to have these opportunities to learn, but it was all part and parcel of running away. Now, I returned to New York in my early 30s, and I still had a lot of problems, but it wasn't until I put everything down, all the drugs, all the snacks, all the laziness and the negativity, and I picked up positive habits that I stopped running. And I used to say I'll never leave New York again. I've gotten to the point now where I'm interested in traveling, but the traveling I'm interested in doing externally is based on internal principles.
I just wanted to go back to, and I wonder if there's a connection here, because I know there was for me. You were an avid reader before you were 3 years old and still are. And you were talking about reading other people's narratives and reading about the world. I always found it a very interesting way to disappear to my room and the issues that were going on in my home. And I found this escape in books. And then once I was actually able to physically travel, I was on planes and around the world and doing that for a career. How much for you do you think was, one, you're the escape of New York and growing up, but also how much of it do you think was that curiosity of reading so much at such a young age, and then wanting to get out there and see the world, and in a way, see if the world itself would help fix your problems?
That hits the nail on the head. Orwell is probably my favorite author, maybe my favorite person of all time. And I made it a point to travel to Barcelona because he fought in the war in 36, 37 to try to retrace his footsteps. And I would just try to lose myself in these people's narratives. A lot of them were pretty self-sacrificial. I had, and I guess I still kind of do have a bit of a martyr complex. It's something I'm working. I don't think I'll ever be able to completely work on it, but I was drawn to these dudes, almost all men. Oh yeah, I was drawn to these men that seemed to be able to marry word and deed. They lived these noble lives and they wrote these noble books and they kind of had this noble existence. And I did wish to disappear into their creation. Though I don't think there's anything wrong inherently with being a cultural consumer. I don't think there's anything wrong intrinsically with these things, but unfortunately, I think there is something wrong with the way it's played out. I think in a vacuum, it would be great to be a literate person, it would be great to be a cinephile, but I've found that a lot of people that are very into these things, they don't want to take a serious glance at themselves. And I know I didn't, because it's very painful. It can be very painful to look at the self. It's why people are obsessed with celebrity culture. It's why I have people on my Instagram feed that watch every single one of my stories. And I'm so happy that they do, but they don't even post, or they would never discuss what they're doing. And it's because you have to move past your pain, really, to talk about it openly. I'm extremely open about my past because I walked it. Before I healed, I didn't even have social media. I was running physically, but I wasn't present in. Now it's the opposite. Now I don't go anywhere, but I'm in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens. Occasionally I go to Westchester to see one of my homeboys. And that's like, I might as well be going to the moon. Whereas back in the day, I would be flying around the world like it was nothing, trying to escape myself and not posting and not sharing. I feel connected to, I got 5 social media followers on the other side of the world. I feel more connected to them now than I ever did to myself when I was physically doing a geographic. That is such a good question. I was seeking to escape and into all.
We've talked about this before, and I went through a pretty intense process with this in my own therapy. Is often keenly intelligent people, someone who learned to read before 3, you and I actually share that in common, are often aware enough or at least in tune enough to either how they're feeling or taking in this stuff. And I like how you talk about the juxtaposition of being like a consumer of art versus a creator and like settling out the differences. I've shared a few times on the podcast how I always struggled with this idea of like the starving and tortured artist idea and how it's so unhealthy and seems to be an unfortunately true stereotype. Where do you think the line can be drawn, or whether it's in something of self-awareness or how you do it, of like looking at these things as something to aspire to, something to think about, but not something you either, when I read Hemingway, it makes me depressed about my own writing. Or when I hear a phenomenal guitar player, I'm like, wow, I could copy that, but can I make that? Can I make it sound the same? And I mean, I have my own answer because it literally, as I'm saying this, I'm like, yeah, well, comparison is the thief of joy. But where do you think that kind of line is, and how did you find peace with it?
Once I started writing, once I started creating, I no longer saw it. Then it didn't matter. Then I was with them. If we are producing to the greatest extent we can, it is impossible to be regretful. Really, it is not possible. We are giving everything we can to the process. How can you regret that? The regretful man is the man that isn't leading a healthy life, that isn't really trying. If you aren't really trying, then you aren't really going to be okay. Then you are going to be looking at the next man, the next woman. You are going to be looking at the past or the future. When I started this process, I was so desperate to change that I would do anything. And I did do anything. I lived on the 5th floor of a walk-up on Delancey Street, on kind of the grittier part of the Lower East Side. Not kind of.
Hold on. It is. I used to play softball not far from Delancey. I know it well.
So my building fronted the Brooklyn Bridge. So on one side of the street was my building. And there was some number of feet. And then there was the bridge. So could not cross Delancey in front of my building. And it was a beautiful apartment. I loved it, but it was on the 5th floor because after my breakup, my ex, shout out to Tori if you're watching, made a killing and she was largely supporting the group. And after we broke up, I was not as well off because I wasn't really trying to do anything with my life. And what do you know? I took this place, but when I decided that my life was worth living and I said I would do anything, I would wake up before dawn around 5 a.m. at the time and work out on the street in front of my building. COVID had shut the gyms down. And there was a lot of outdoor dining, like three-walled hutch situations. And I found one and I would kick whatever drug stuff out of the way. Sometimes junkies would be in there or people getting high on God knows what. And they didn't pay me any mind. And I would be working out down there. So and after that, I was fat. I was not okay at all mentally or physically. But after I really tried on that workout, you couldn't tell me a damn thing. I might as well have been Mr. Olympia. And I really mean that. And anyone who's watching that is feeling down about their minds and or their bodies, essentially the same thing. If you really give your workout your all, it is not possible. If you hit the ski slope and do the double black diamond and absolutely do everything you can to be the best out there, how can you feel bad when you finish the route? And that is the thing I never understood because I never gave anything my all. Because I didn't think I was worth it. The work instills the worth. If you are working really hard on something, then you feel valid. If you are trying to learn guitar and you practice till your fingers bleed, how are you going to beat yourself up about not being the next Hendrix? It's not possible. I made YouTube for a year and a half. My stuff got like, I think my best video got like 1,000 views. I thought I was a damn Anthony Bourdain. You couldn't tell me a damn thing because every morning I woke up at 4 And I sat and I wrote, and I would rewrite and draft, and I wrote a script. I uploaded onto my phone, and on the weekends I would shoot. At the same time, I was working a full-time tech job. I was working 60, 70 hours a week, and I was working out 7 days a week. I wasn't doing anything. My first 6 months on this program, I did not do anything but eat right, train, read and write, and do social media. And that's all I did. And what do you know? My shit looks so hood rich. If I rewatch my stuff now, it's cringeworthy, but at the time it didn't matter because I didn't think I was Bourdain, but you couldn't tell me. It was like Tony Bourdain was the king of this, another suicide, unfortunately. Yes. He's the king of this. And it didn't matter what my stuff looked like because I was putting in as much effort as he did.
I love it. The work instills the worth. That is wonderful.
Yeah. And as you were talking through that, I had many of my own kind of flashbacks. Bourdain is one of my heroes, and what he was able to do to bring people together and connect people, and that whole gritty side. And as you were talking about that, I'm imagining you outside your apartment complex during COVID in one of those makeshift outdoor dining areas and just deciding, like, fuck everybody else. Like, I am all in right now on changing the trajectory of John's physical life and John's mental life. And I'm tired of living the way I did, which is so ironic because so many people during COVID, it was the opposite. People started to isolate. People didn't want to go outside. And in many ways, it sounds like COVID was the time when you decided, I'm going to thrive.
Yeah, I mean, and desperation gets a bad rap, but desperation is one of the best motivators on earth. The truly desperate man who will do anything to feel better is unstoppable. I don't think people are desperate enough. Most of the desperation I see is in a negative way. They're desperate to get high, eat some garbage. They're desperate to hook up. They're desperate. Also, there's like a money desperation that's extremely negative. There's a lot of like negative desperations, but I finally flipped the switch and I was desperate for change and I would do anything. I mean, it was freezing. I got sober January 19th, 2021. And a little more than 3 years ago. And it was freezing. It was the middle of winter. And I did not give a fuck. I couldn't. It was freedom or death. It was a struggle, a life or death struggle to go do push-ups and burpees and all the bodyweight exercises because the gyms were closed outside. I would do that. And then I would go into my apartment and do a weight training workout. But you can't do burpees and
jump on the fifth floor of a walk-up. Yeah.
Yeah. New York City apartment doesn't really lend itself to that.
Like anybody who's watching or listening and who feels desperate, that's a good thing. All you have to do is harness that. Also, extremely negative people have the ability to be extremely positive. The middle of the road, like kind of go through life derping from one thing to another, not really caring. Those people, they can't really change because the axis hasn't swung far enough into the bad. If you have had a really tough time with mental health, if you've been really fat, if you have had serious trauma, these are the people that can change the most. The people that are just kind of also, I also don't even buy that anyone is okay, but the people that do the best job of pretending that they're okay, the middle of the road people, they're not good candidates for this podcast or for like life stuff. They're good candidates for being in the middle. But the real extreme individuals, like I'm an extremely negative, dark person, extreme. And you just invert that and then you have the ability to become an extremely positive, bright person. I'm not saying that I am that, but I'm saying that I'm working my way towards that. And actually, in moments of clarity, I am. And then nobody's ever free of anything. So in my dark moments, then I feel like I'm back in the pit. But it's just about being honest. That's the other thing. There's like a fat acceptance thing that is so dishonest and is going to lead to so much death. And like people talk about body positivity. I was fat. I know what it's like. Something that pisses me off is a lot of people that are in shape want to talk about acceptance. I'm like, if you have always been in shape, how dare you? How dare you say that you accept fat people or you accept certain things? Like, it really bothers me because when I was fat, I did not accept myself. I did not like the way I looked. And what do you know? If you don't like the way you look, how the fuck are you going to like the way you feel? I hated myself. And I was lied to by a society that told me I should accept myself. And that's very frustrating. Acceptance is one of the highest level energy fields. but you have to work on yourself to accept yourself. And that's a big lie that I want to counteract, because I took that hook, line, and sinker. I just said, oh, well, it's who I am. You better love it. It's like, dude, what? So that's definitely something that I'm on.
On that topic, because we know mental health and physical health are intertwined like strands of DNA, right? And why has that narrative become so accepted in today's society?
Think of the money behind it. I call my channel and my whole coaching business, this is Foodways Coaching. This is NYC Foodways. A foodway is a cultural pathway through food. So if you talk about indigenous foodways of parts of what is now known as Central America, they had a way of growing food, beans, squash, and corn, and the milpa, and it sustained people for tens of thousands of years, maybe longer. And this is a foodway, right? It's a cultural pathway through food. Right now, food is becoming less and less of something that's cultural or connected to the earth and simply a delivery mechanism of economic resources from humans to corporations and governments, which is essentially the same thing. And the amount of money there is in the so-called body positivity, if you allow people and tell people to eat whatever they want, damn the consequences, the medical industry will skyrocket. You will have perpetual massive consumer force to eat all of the hydrogenated garbage, and you will have a population too stupid and lazy and large to think for yourself. When I was lazy and large, I could not think of anything past getting my next fix, whatever it was. So that's why this has happened, because like everything else, there is a shitload of money behind being unhealthy. The top 10 causes of death in this country are largely environmental. It used to be women dying in childbirth. I hope we never go back there. That's why the life expectancy has doubled, is because far fewer women and babies die in childbirth anymore. But it's been replaced by a ton of environmental factors, such as the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food. That's why. These are all massive money-making opportunities for governments and corporations, which is essentially, like I said, the same thing. And that's why. It's sickening. And this is the industry I work in. And it all comes down to what we consume. And it was when I stopped consuming the garbage and started eating essentially like people ate two or three generations ago, that my whole life changed. Dude, I haven't been sick in 3 years. Straight up. I've not missed a day of work in 3 years. I used to have these chronic health issues, awkward rashes, strange breathing problems, like all these, not to mention the mental illness and like my inability to tie my sneakers. So there's three things. There's practical things like tying your sneakers, the mental health issues that almost drove me to suicide. And then there's like the everyday I'm sick type things. I don't have that anymore. And our ancestors didn't really have that either, unless it was something communicated. Yeah, man, it all comes down to what we consume. And we are told to consume these things in a certain way because there's a shitload of money.
I want to come back to that. So we're going to revisit, because obviously I want to talk about the work you're doing and that stuff too. But I've just been struck by this juxtaposition, because a few of the people we've mentioned who are some of my heroes, and unfortunately the list is really long, all died by suicide. Right? You think about Robin Williams, Anthony Bourdain, and the list goes on and on.
Walter Wallace, Hemingway.
Ernest Hemingway. And then even you think about some women, Marilyn Monroe, we're not really quite sure. Kurt Cobain, we're not really quite sure. Sylvia Plath, we are sure. Avicii, Margot Kidder. I mean, it goes on and on. Oscar Wilde,
it's a lot
questionable.
Debatable, yes.
Debatable as well. Edgar Allan Poe, debatable. He either committed suicide or somebody killed him. What do you think that is? And this is for both of you. Like, go ahead and riff, both of you. That juxtaposition between sheer genius, like the top of what we experience as humans, right? Robin Williams literally brought more experience and joy and changed more people's minds with some of the movies he made than maybe any other media figure, and spoke at length about his addiction and depression. He's the first person I ever heard say, hey, that person who's the life of the party and telling all the jokes, check in on them. They're probably not doing well. What do you think that is? Why does that exist in our society the way it does?
So something I came up with a long time. A lot of people, I'm not saying on this lovely podcast, but I notice a lot of people when they have these things, it's just redoing what other people, and God bless, because every word we speak is based on the trillions of words that have been spoken before us. But something that I came up with is that art and pain are two sides of the same coin. I really do believe that an artist's ability to create beauty is one-to-one parallel to whatever pain they've experienced. And I've worked with a number of artists, and I've made art myself. And you can just look at the greatest artists that you just mentioned, and they have a ton of pain. They were all harmed to some degree, usually in their childhoods. Hemingway, I think he was forced to wear dresses by his mother, if I remember correctly, and had some other
child. You are correct. And he was not allowed at times to write because what he wrote was disturbing to his family.
Yeah. And Foster Wallace, there's some mystery around what he went through, but I read his work extensively, and I did read the biography written about him. A lot of these, almost all of these artists, they express their art as a way of coping with their pain, as a way of expressing the pain that they have inside. And that's where the beauty comes from, the fact that they are in a lot of pain, and that's how they express themselves. It's therapeutic to create art. And the comedian thing is true. A lot of comedy is a coping mechanism. I used to make a lot of jokes, and I used to do a lot of that type of stuff to try to mute or try to distract people from the fact that I was very sad and that I was in a lot of pain. So art and pain are two sides of the same coin, and good art is just pain expressed onto a notepad or onto a canvas. I'm not going to turn the camera around, but after I kind of got out of my own way, I started picking up pieces of art, stuff that I'm into. I have a 19th century print of the state of Louisiana. It's very beautiful. I have a custom rug, tufted rug. I love art because I feel connected to the energy behind whatever the piece is, which is often some sort of pain or some sort of joy or some sort of beauty. And pain and joy are also very closely linked. And that's why these artists, these cultural figures, end up producing all this stuff. And then it's all passing on young. 27 Club, we mentioned. There's also Hunter S. Thompson, killed himself. He said 65 was old enough.
Yeah, well, we live in his valley, and this is where they launched the rocket with his ashes.
Yes. We are about 10 miles away from where Hunter lived.
I know his surviving widow, Anita Thompson, actually quite well.
There's a great clip of him on YouTube in a gun battle with his...
Yes.
This deranged individual
shooting right down the road.
Yep.
You know what I'm
talking about?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. Black. Like, this guy is nuts, but he's obviously nuts. But what does it mean to be nuts? I would go as far as to say all three of us are. And what's wrong with that? All my heroes are nuts. You know what's interesting? I don't think Orwell was. I don't know what drove him to make the most beautiful. He also went to Spain and put his life on the line, which is something that a lot of kind of mentally ill people.
Well, Hemingway did too, right? I mean, Hemingway fought in the Spanish Civil War.
He fought in World War One.
World War One
correspondent.
He was a correspondent in the Spanish Civil War. That's it. Thank you. I was like, I'm switching which war he was which. But as a correspondent, he was literally one of the first correspondents to ever go to the front lines with like bullets flying over his head to write about it. I agree with everything you just said, John. And the thing that I struggle with, and I'll say this and then let Eric kind of fill in what he's thinking or feeling about it, is I always wanted art to be therapeutic personally, right? Like I would see people create these beautiful things, and I am fully guilty of this, hand up. And I've written plays, screenplays, written music, done a bunch of creating. And I was never able to create that little bit of distance to find joy in it at times. And I'm getting better at it. I always had this like critical and judgmental sense of it. And I wonder if that's part of it. Is like even someone like Hemingway who's at the... And Hunter S. Thompson actually said this. He not only said 65 was enough, he was like, I'm writing the same shit. I'm not doing anything new. I'm out. He was like, basically the sponge had been wrung dry. And I wonder if there is that juxtaposition of like, if you have that level of genius, you're also willing to look at yourself and be like, I'm declining. I'm not doing this. I can't do anything better than what I did yesterday and not find. And what I see is in myself, I find fulfillment and contentment and so many other things around it. I still enjoy art. I have stacks of art that we don't have room to put up in our house that Amy and I won't get rid of. But I wonder that juxtaposition of like, you create these things, even if it is as therapy or to deal with the pain, but then it helps and heals others, but it doesn't necessarily do that for the artist.
I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with what you were saying. And I was just having a conversation a couple of days ago with a friend of mine. And I was saying, you know, as we have the podcast and I get to speak publicly. But where I find myself to be most creative is when I'm sitting down and I'm writing. And whether it's a book or an article or just something that is going into my journal, I'm able to really transpose what my thoughts are at that particular point in time. And I'm able to, it's kind of like going on a trip is the way I think about it. And you have a suitcase and you have all this stuff in your suitcase and it's heavy and it's weighing you down and you finally get to your room and you get a chance to unpack the suitcase and start to put things away. And I feel like that's what that creative process does from a mental health standpoint for me. And it sounds in many ways that creativity for you. And I go back to your, you know, what you said initially at the beginning of the show, happiness is an inside job, that you were able to reach inside of you and figure out where that creativity was able to come from and start doing the things you were doing. And now you've turned that into, right, New York City Food Waste and a program. Love to hear more about that, that other people can now benefit from what you created so that they too can have a happy physical and mental cognitive life.
Yeah. And the wildest thing is once I stripped away all the complicated ideas, all of my dumbass college education, all the stupid books that I read, and all of this shit that I was told that I needed to do as part of the thing that a bunch of mentally ill people also did, that's what was left. It was an intentional program, personal development, that involves three main pillars. One, a non-negotiable early wake up. Two, intense daily physical exercise. And three, intentional nutrition based on custom macronutrients that my coach at the time had given me. And all I did was those three things. I was obsessed with those three things. And I clung to those three things to keep me away from the bag of coke and the dating apps, to keep me away from the shitty food and the bottle of gin. I drank gin like crazy, kept me away from the mushroom bag and all of these things that I encountered on my path. And because middle-class white person, you could essentially do whatever you want with your life. Drugs or alcohol, there's no real consequences unless you hurt someone else. And this is what the program is. People that have come to me in the past and people that come to me in the future will be given the same instructions that I was given. Strip away. The growth is a reductive process. You have to remove things from your life to grow. Adding a bunch of extra shit into your life, which is what most people do to distract themselves from their pain, just keeps you pressed down. It's like, if you have a very heavy burden, why on earth would you put more on there? You need to release yourself from all of these negative habits. And then with that goes the negativity and the resentments and all that other negative shit we carry around with us. And in walking this path and then living this program, I realized that we're all pretty much lied to. It's like a big circle of lies. Like, I want to be able to chase pleasure, so I'm not going to criticize you for chasing pleasure. And then if we're both chasing pleasure together, then obviously we're not going to criticize each other and we can just go and do all the bullshit we want. And I want to share one anecdote about skiing. On my drug using days, I used to eat mushroom. It was one of my favorite things. And one time I did that and went snowboarding and it was pretty surreal. It was a very surreal experience. And I thought that these types of experiences, you can only have these experiences while high. You can only have these experiences while high. I was thinking about going to Peru to try ayahuasca, and it was all of these things. And then once I got sober and I got my shit together, I think the highest I've ever been in my life has been following these workouts. I used to burst into tears. I used to have these transcendental, real spiritual experiences. I didn't feel it. We're always connected, but I both felt connected to the universe and was connected to the universe, which is nothing I ever felt when I was on mushrooms. And even if I was on acid or God knows Molly or whatever, and I felt that way, it was from some chemical or something outside of myself. So all the drug addicts and drug users out there, all my party people, the raves, I used to go to a lot of raves, like a lot of weird, like freaky parties, costumes and shit. All you guys that think you can only be yourself in those things, it's those things that are masking yourself. The costume you're wearing is a costume that you're wearing to try to hide yourself from other people, but as soon as you take off the costume, whatever the costume is, and you become comfortable with who you are in your own skin, it's the greatest high. One of my favorite rappers, he died not long ago, Black Gift of Gab from Blackalicious. He had his own solo stuff under Gift of Gab, but commonly known by, as one of the rapper in Blackalicious. He said, the greatest high is the natural high within. And I used to joke and I used to say, whoever said that the greatest high is the natural high within is never done. And then I would insert whatever drug I was doing. I thought it was very funny, make fun of sober people. And now I realize that he's gone, by the way, but I realize he didn't kill himself. He was just extremely overweight. He was like 300 pounds. So it's crazy. All this stuff is connected. But the greatest high is the natural high within, because anything we feel when we're high is based on a chemical we have within our bodies. So if it's within our bodies anyway, we can feel it anyway without the use of external inputs and external influences. And all this external shit, this fucking external world. The ancients and the people before us, they knew what was up. They knew that you go on long walks or you trek up the mountain because it's very arduous and difficult. You have fast days. Every religion, every culture has fast days, and you don't lie. Dude, you look at the 10, my people's, possibly your.
Yes, the two of us are dry members, John. Mark is a recovering Catholic.
And just to be clear, the Catholics also have the 10 commandments. Just
so if you like, people want to read all these books, self-help stuff. Just look at the 10 commandments. This is from the Bronze Age, by the way. Look at this Bronze Age thing and just do that. If everyone just did that from 5,500 years ago, we'd be fine. But people want to make it complex and have a shitload of this and that and get diagnosed and get all these pills and all this other stuff and be relying on the pharmaceutical system, be relying on the school system, be relying on the legal system to tell them what they should and shouldn't do. If you need a law to tell you not to kill, rape, and steal, there's something seriously wrong with you. Like, if you need a bunch of laws to tell you what is okay and what isn't okay, that's the biggest thing. The biggest thing is we have farmed. I used to farm all of my decision-making capabilities out. I'll let the system tell me the way I should act. I'll let my job tell me what type of money I should make. I'll let the culture tell me what sort of person I should be in my romantic engagements. I'll let all these people inform me of the man I should be, and I just won't listen to my conscience. And when I stop listening to my friends and stop listening to my family and stop listening to the media and stop listening to politicians, stop giving a shit about anything other than my own mental and physical well-being, what do you know? I dropped 45 pounds. I haven't touched any substances in over 3 years. I refuse to do any negative romantic engagements. And I've had people, man, listen, people are going to approach you and stuff. And if you don't have the right intentions in your heart, you're just going to be hurt even more after. So I cut all that stuff out of my life. And now I get to hop on podcasts with two other like-minded dudes. And it's like, I never in a million years thought I would be doing any of this. Living, first of all, I own my own apartment. I have a great job. I have a side hustle. I started in the fall. I'm like running an Amazon storefront. I just cleared 20 grand. Like, there's all this stuff. And honestly, fuck the money. That was the last thing on my mind. I never, ever expected anything external from this. I just wanted to be okay. That's the craziest thing. I just wanted to not hate myself. And I knew that if I ate right, because food affects your mood, woke up early because life is a gratitude test and you need to show gratitude to the universe for your spirit, and worked out because body is a temple and we don't want to desecrate our temple, I would feel okay for that day. And I just did that for 3 years. And here I stand, a completely changed.
It's such an amazing story, John. And while we're on that topic of weight, because that was such a big part for you, the self-esteem, right? And not feeling physically well, which leads to not feeling mentally well. I'm curious what you think, and maybe it's a little bit off topic to come back on topic, but this whole Ozempic, Jardiance craze, and I'm wondering how it's going to affect people down the road. Because the initial impact, right, is you have this herd mentality of all these people taking these type 2 diabetes drugs because they know it's a quick way to lose a whole lot of weight as an appetite suppressant. As someone who is super knowledgeable, as you are, about food and the importance of food, at what point do the scales then tip, pardon the pun, and these people who are depriving themselves of food because of this drug that they're using, their mental health starts to take a real negative turn?
I mean, it's just like anything else. It's using an external solution for an internal problem. If they have something wrong with them inside, as I think all of us do, and they go to the I don't even know what doctor this is. Like, who, I don't even know who prescribes that. And go to the, and they go to the doctor in order to find the solution. Well, then they haven't really found the solution. The doctor has found the solution. It's like those people that say, oh, I went to a spirit retreat and we smoked peyote or whatever, and I felt connected with the divine. Well, if you have to smoke peyote to feel connected to the divine, then you don't actually have the connection. If you have to take Ozempic, then you haven't trained yourself. Because what happens if the medical establishment collapses? What happens if we, what happens if that drug gets banned? Then you're going to be obese again? Like, this is, that's the danger of it that I see, is that you are reliant on something outside of yourself to feel okay inside, even if it's effective. And here's the thing, I'm not doubting that it's effective. I'm not, I was so happy when I was high. I can't tell you, I was overjoyed. Now, the joy was short-lived and temporary and had a massive downside. But people talk about, oh, well, the point of life is to be happy. If you look at a heroin addict who's getting, who just shot up, they're very happy. So it's like, I don't buy anything else. I don't buy into, I don't give credence to any external solutions to an internal problem. And I know a lot of people listening, and possibly other people that I'm speaking to right now, are prescribed. And I don't want to take anything away from that, because I got prescribed all that stuff as well. But taking the pills and whatnot never, it never helped me, because I knew without them that I wouldn't be okay. And I don't want to speak negative about anyone's path. I can only speak of mine.
Well,
because I was prescribed them, I did take them, and they didn't.
Yeah, but if they don't work, it's different. And John, the thing I would say is, we're up for whatever helps people. It doesn't matter. And your path is yours. But the thing is that I would say is, there's always two sides to every coin, right? So it's like, yeah, if it's helping, but like, if there is a cost associated. And I think, even look at how our government currently operates and how much debt most people operate with that are very comfortable with. Like, we are very good as a culture, specifically Western culture right now, of kicking responsibility down the road. And I'll put my hand up, I'm not guilty of this. And I think there is a sense of, and when I hear you talk, it's like, it's that idea of balancing between what we do now and what we're doing overall, and the cost, and versus what it does to take care of us, is what I take from what you're saying. And look, if medication is helping and there isn't that backside cost, but what you speak of also balances those, right? Like, what if that doesn't exist? What if you don't have that? And I think that's an important thing to kind of come down to. But as we're getting ready to wrap up here, I want to make sure people will, of course, have the links, everything listed. But if someone's just listening, how do they find you on your YouTube channel? Find all these things that you're doing. We want to make sure they know where to find you.
Best way to get in touch is on Instagram at NYC Foodways. That is NYCFOODWAYS. I have a YouTube channel by the same name that has some cool cultural content. I was working things out, figuring out what I wanted to do with this whole social media project. I did about 75 weeks running of videos, but I'm putting out content every day. For anyone that's interested in changing their life, tune in. I show my workouts. I talk about recipes, show my wake up, mindset tips, ways to stay strong in the face of adversity. So you can check me out. And if you want to tap in further, I have custom everything for anyone that's interested in hopping on the team and truly planting a flag against this. Salvation is available for anyone who wishes to be saved. And even though I may be the conduit, nobody is coming to save you. This is a choice that you're going to have to make for yourself to decide that your life is worth living, and your life is worth living. Take it from someone who used to not think their life was worth anything. Takes a full commitment towards a process to change you, and healing is on the other side of your pain.
I know. So there,
I know. We're both like, well, I'm not really going to say anything. What I'm going to say is, Eric, if there's anything you'd like to add, otherwise, John, I just want to say thank you. You just summed up everything we just talked about so beautifully, John. Thank you.
Yes. And I think in so many ways, you summed up really what our show and what so many other shows and books and people who are involved in this space is all about. When you talk about no one's coming to save you, you have to save yourself, and you have to realize, like, I'm going to come back again to what you said earlier. Happiness is an inside job. Unless you know that something is wrong, and as you said, there's probably something slightly off and wrong about all of us, no one is going to come riding in on a white horse to save you. And what you've done and how you've done it is so incredibly amazing. And I just want to thank you for doing the work that you're doing. It's so very important. And I would urge anyone who's listening to this show today to go check out John's Instagram. It's really fun to watch. You get videos of him walking around New York City, which is, it, for me, it's nostalgic, and it's also informative and interesting as well. And you too can change the path and trajectory of your journey just like John did. There's no way and no reason why you shouldn't be able to.
Well, and I'm glad my mic was off because I was going to step all over you. But the thing that it made me occur to is, like, of course no one else can come in on this white horse. Half the time, if not more than half the time, we're trying to save ourselves from ourselves. We're the fucking problem.
Exactly.
And again, hand up, not pointing fingers, hand up. John, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Salute you both. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. And looking forward to, I already actually just jumped on, followed you on Instagram, and can't wait to learn more about you and what you do. And with that, I will say a huge thank you to our wonderful guest, John Katz, my co-host, Eric DeRosa. Sorry for yelling at you. This is Mark Fernandes, and this is From Survivor to Thriver, episode 156. And with that, I will leave us with the words I always do. Let's please all be as well as we can.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to our show and leave us a review. Also, we'd love if you could share this episode with a friend and encourage you to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or email via the links in our show notes. See you next week!